he loved any of his brother's children. There had been times he had awoken from dreams in which terrible things had happened to them, with his face wet with tears. But that might have been guilt. He had lacked either the ability to raise them or the bravery to let the Clave replace him with a better guardian. Oh, who would have kept them together? No one, perhaps. And a family should be together. The door at the foot of the stairs creaked. Arthur turned eagerly. Perhaps Julian had thought better of his mad plan and returned. The Moon's Road was dangerous. The sea itself was full of treachery. He had grown up near the sea, in Cornwall, and he recalled its monsters. "And bitter as blood is the spray, and the crests are as fangs that devour." Or perhaps there never been monsters. She appeared at the top of the steps and looked at him coolly. Her hair was pulled back so tightly her skin seemed stretched. She tilted her head, taking in the cramped, dirty room, the papered-over windows. There was something in her face, something that stirred a flicker of memory, something that made cold terror wash through him. He gripped the arms of his chair, his mind chattering with bits of old poetry. Her skin was white as leprosy. The nightmare life in death was she. "Arthur Blackthorne, I presume," she said with a demure smile. "I'm Zara Dearborn. I believe you knew my father." Emma landed hard on thick grass, tangled up in Julian. For a moment he was propped over her, elbows on the ground, his pale face luminous in the moonlight. The air around them was cold, but his body was warm against hers. She felt the expansion of his chest as he inhaled, a sharp breath, the current of air against her cheek as he turned his face quickly away from hers. A moment later he was on his feet, reaching down to pull her up after him. But she scrambled upright on her own, spinning around to see they were standing in a clearing surrounded by trees. The moonlight was bright enough for Emma to see that the grass was intensely green. The trees hung with fruit that was vividly colored. Purple plums, red apples, star and rose-shaped fruits that Emma didn't recognize. Mark and Christina were there too, under the trees. Mark had pushed the sleeves of his shirt up and was holding his hands out as if he were touching the air of Fairy, feeling it on his skin. He tipped his head back, his mouth slightly open. Emma, looking at him, blushed. It felt like a private moment, as if she were watching someone reconnect with a lover. "Emma," Christina breathed. "Look." She pointed upward at the sky. The stars were different. They arched and whirled in patterns that Emma didn't recognize, and they had colors. Icy blue, frost green, shimmering gold, brilliant silver. "It's so beautiful," she whispered. She saw Julian look over at her, but it was Mark who spoke. He no longer looked quite so abandoned to the night, but he still seemed a little dazed, as if the air of Fairy were wine and he had drunk too much. "The hunt rode through the sky of Fairy sometimes," he said. "In the sky, the stars looked like the crushed dust of jewels, powdered ruby and sapphire and diamond." "I knew about the stars in Fairy," Christina said in an awed, quiet voice, "but I never thought I would see them myself."
"Should we rest?" Julian asked.
He was prowling the outline of the clearing, peering between the trees. "Trust Jules to ask the practical questions. Gather our energy for traveling tomorrow?" Mark shook his head.
"We can't. We must travel through the night. I know how to navigate the lands only by stars."
"Then we're going to need energy runes." Emma held out her arm to Christina. It wasn't meant as a deliberate snub to Jules. Runes your Parabatai put on you were always more powerful, but she could still feel where his body had crushed against hers when they'd fallen. She could still feel the visceral twist inside her when his breath had ghosted against her cheek,
She needed him not to be close to her right now, not to see what was in her eyes. The way Mark had looked at the sky of Faerie, that was how she imagined she looked at Julian. Christina's touch was warm and comforting, her steely swift and skilled, its tip tracing the shape of an energy rune onto Emma's forearm. Finished, she let Emma's wrist go. Emma waited for the usual alert, searing heat like a double jolt of caffeine. Nothing happened. "It's not working," she said with a frown. "Let me see." Christina stepped forward. She glanced down at Emma's skin, and her eyes widened. "Look." The mark, black as ink when Christina had placed it on Emma's forearm, was turning pale and silvery, fading like melting frost. In seconds it had blended back into Emma's skin and was gone. "What on earth?" Emma began, but Julian had already whirled on Mark. "Runes," he said. "Do they work in Faerie?" Mark looked astonished. "It had never occurred to me that they wouldn't," he said. "No one's ever mentioned it." "I've studied Faerie for years," Christina said. "I've never seen it said anywhere that runes do not work in the lands." "When was the last time you tried to use one here?" Emma asked Mark. He shook his head, blonde curls falling into his eyes. He shoved them back with narrow fingers. "I can't remember," he said. "I didn't have a steely. They broke it, but my witch light always worked." He dug into his pocket and drew out a round, polished runestone. They all watched, breathless, as he held it up, waiting for the light to come, to shine brilliantly from his palm. Nothing happened. With a soft curse, Julian drew one of his seraph blades from his belt. The adamas gleamed dully in the moonlight. He turned it so that the blade lay flat, reflecting the multicolored brilliance of the stars. "Michael," he said. Something sparked inside the blade, a brief, dull gleam. Then it was gone. Julian stared at it. A seraph blade that could not be brought to life was barely more than a plastic knife, dull-bladed, heavy, and short. With a violent jerk of his arm, Julian cast the blade aside. It skidded across the grass. He raised his eyes. Emma could sense how tightly he was holding back. She felt it like a pressure in her own body that made it hard to breathe. "So," he said, "we're going to have to journey across Faerie, a place where shadow hunters aren't welcome, using only the stars to navigate. And we can't use runes, seraph blades, or witch light? Is that the situation, roughly?"
"I would say it's the situation exactly," said Mark.
"Also, we're heading for the Unseelie Court," Emma added, "which is supposed to be like one of those horror movies Drew likes, but less, you know, fun."
"Then we will travel at night," Christina said. She pointed into the distance. "There are landmarks that I've seen on maps. Do you see those ridges in the distance against the sky? I think those are the Thorn Mountains. The Unseelie lands lie in their shadow. It's not so far away."
Emma could see Mark relax at the sound of Christina's sensible voice. It didn't seem to be working on Julian, though. His jaw was clenched, his hands, rigid fists at his sides. It wasn't that Julian didn't get angry. It was that he didn't let himself show it. People thought he was quiet, calm, but that was deceptive. Emma recalled something that she had read once, that volcanoes had the lushest green slopes, the loveliest and quietest aspect, because the fire that pulsed through them kept their earth from ever freezing. But when they erupted, they could rain down devastation for miles.
"Jules," she said. He glanced over at her. Fury gleamed behind his eyes. "We might not have witch light or runes, but we are still shadow hunters. With everything that means, we can do this. We can."
It felt like a clumsy speech to her, but she saw the fire die in his eyes.
"You're right," he said. "Sorry."
"And I'm sorry for bringing you all here," said Mark. "If I had known about the runes. But it must be something recent, very much so."
"You didn't bring us here," said Christina. "We followed you. And we all came through not just for you,
but because of what the Pooka told each of us. Isn't that true?
One you have loved and lost.
It's true for me, said Emma. She glanced at the sky. We should get going, though. Morning is probably in just a few hours. And if we don't have energy runes, we'll have to get our energy the old-fashioned way.
Mark looked puzzled.
Drugs?
Chocolate, Emma said. I brought chocolate.
Mark, where do you even come up with these things?
Mark smiled crookedly, shrugging one shoulder.
Fairy humor?
I thought fairies mostly made jokes at other people's expense and played pranks on mundanes, said Julian.
Sometimes they tell very long, rhyming stories they think are hilarious, said Mark. But I have to admit, I never really understood why.
Julian sighed.
That actually sounds worse than anything else I've heard about the Unseelie Court.
Mark shot Julian a grateful look, as if to say he understood that his brother had mastered his temper, in part for him, for all of them, so that they would be all right, so that they could continue on their way and find Kieran, with Julian leading them, as he always did.
Come, Mark said, turning. It is this way. We should begin walking. It may not be very many more hours until dawn.
Mark headed into the shadows between the trees. Mist clung to the branches like ropes of white and silver. Leaves rustled softly in the wind above their heads. Julian moved to walk up ahead next to his brother. Emma could hear him asking,
"Puns? At least promise me there won't be puns."
"The way the boys tell each other they love each other is so very odd," said Christina as she and Emma ducked beneath a branch. "Why can't they just say it? Is it so difficult?"
Emma grinned at her friend.
"I love you, Christina," she said, "and I'm glad you're getting to visit Fairy, even if it's under weird circumstances. Maybe you can find a hot fairy guy and forget about imperfect Diego."
Christina smiled.
"I love you too, Emma," she said, "and maybe I will."
Kit's list of grievances against the Shadow Hunters had now gotten long enough that he'd started writing it down.
"Stupid, hot people," he'd written, "won't let me go home and get my stuff. They won't tell me anything about what it would mean to actually become a Shadow Hunter. Would I have to go somewhere and train? They won't tell me how long I can stay here, except as long as you need to. Don't I have to go to school eventually? Some kind of school? They won't talk about the cold piece or how it sucks. They won't let me eat cookies."
He thought for a while, and then crossed that one out. They did let him eat cookies. He just suspected they were judging him for it.
"They don't seem to understand what autism is, or mental illness, or therapy, or medical treatment. Do they believe in things like chemotherapy? What if I get cancer? Probably won't get cancer, but if I did. They won't tell me how Tessa and Jem found my dad, or why my dad hated Shadowhunters so much."
That one was the hardest to write. Kit had always thought of his father as a small-time con man, a lovable rogue, a sort of Han Solo type, swindling his way across the galaxy. But lovable rogues don't get torn apart by demons the moment their elaborate protection spells fall apart. And though mostly Kit was confused by what had happened at the Shadow Market, he had learned one thing. His dad had not been like Han Solo. Sometimes, in the dark watches of the night, Kit wondered who he was like himself. Speaking of the dark watches of the night, he had a new grievance to add to his list. "They make me get up early." Diana, whose official title was tutor, and who seemed to function as a guardian slash high school principal, had woken Kit up early in the morning and herded him, along with Ty and Livy, into a corner office with an expansive view and a massive glass desk. She looked pissed off the way adults sometimes looked pissed off when they were angry at someone else, but they were going to take it out on you. Kit was correct. Diana was currently furious at Julian, Emma, Mark, and Christina, who, according to Arthur, had disappeared to Fairy in the dead of night to rescue someone named Kieran, who Kit had never met. Further discussion illuminated that Kieran was the son of the Unseelie King and Mark's ex-boyfriend,
both of which were interesting pieces of information that Kit filed away for later.
"This is not good," Diana finished. "Any travel to Faerie is entirely off limits to Nephilim, without special permissions."
"But they'll come back, right?" Ty said. He sounded strained.
"Mark will come back."
"Of course they'll come back," said Livy. "It's just a mission, a rescue mission," she added, turning to Diana.
"Won't the Clave understand they had to go?"
"Rescuing a fairy? No," Diana said, shaking her head. "They are not entitled to our protection under the Accords. The Centaurians can't know. The Clave would be furious."
"I won't tell," said Ty.
"I won't either," agreed Livy. "Obviously." They both looked at Kit.
"I don't even know why I'm here," he said.
"You have a point," said Livy. She turned to Diana. "Why is he here?"
"You seem to have a way of knowing everything," Diana said to Kit. "I thought it would be better to control your information and get a promise from you."
"That I won't tell? Of course I won't tell. I don't even like Centaurians. They're what I always thought Shadowhunters would be like. You're not. You're all different.
Jerks," he finished.
"I cannot believe," Livy said, "that Julian and them have found a fun adventure to go on and just left the rest of us here to fetch towels for the Centaurians."
Diana looked surprised.
"I thought you'd be upset," she said, "worried about them."
Livy shook her head. Her long hair, shades lighter than Ty's, flew around her.
"That they're off having fun and getting to see Faerie while we drudge around here? When they get back, I'm going to have words with Julian."
"Which words?" Ty looked confused for a moment before his face cleared.
"Oh," he said, "you're going to curse him out."
"I'm going to use every bad word I know."
"Look up some other ones," said Livy.
Diana was biting her lip.
"You're really all right?"
Ty nodded. "Christina has studied Faerie extensively. Mark was a hunter, and Julian and Emma are clever and brave," he said. "I'm sure they'll be fine."
Diana looked stunned.
Kit had to admit he was surprised, too. The Blackthorns had struck him as a family so close-knit that Imesh didn't begin to cover it. But Livy kept up her cheerful annoyance when they went to tell Drew and Tavi that the others had gone to the Shadow Hunter Academy to fetch something. She was quite convincing, too, as she told them how Christina had gone along, because visiting the academy was now a required part of one's travel year. And they repeated the same story to a glowering Diego and a bunch of Centaurians, including his fiancée, who Kit had taken to calling Loathsome Zara in his mind.
"In sum," Livy finished sweetly, "you may have to launder some of your own towels. Now, if you'll excuse us, Ty and I are going to take Kit here on a tour of the perimeter."
Zara arched an eyebrow.
"The perimeter?"
"The wards you just put up," said Livy, and marched outside. She didn't actually drag Ty and Kit after her physically, but something about the force of her personality accomplished basically the same thing. The Institute doors fell shut behind them, as she was already clattering down the front steps.
"Did you see the look on those Centaurians' faces?" she demanded as they made their way around the massive side of the Institute.
She was wearing boots and denim shorts that showed off her long, tanned legs. Kit attempted to seem as if he wasn't looking.
"I don't think they appreciated what you said about washing their own towels," said Ty.
"Maybe I should have drawn them a map to where the detergent is," said Livy. "You know, since they like maps so much."
Kit laughed. Livy glanced over at him, half suspicious.
"What?"
They passed the parking lot behind the Institute and reached a low hedge of sagebrush, behind which was a statuary garden. Greek playwrights and historians stood around in plaster poses, holding wreaths of laurel. It seemed oddly out of place, but then Los Angeles was a city of things that didn't seem like they belonged where they were.
"It was funny," Kit said. "That was all."
She smiled. Her blue T-shirt matched her eyes, and the sunlight found the red and copper threads in her dark brown hair and made them shine. At first, Kit had been a little unnerved by how much the Blackthorns all looked like each other, except Ty, of course. But he had to admit, if he had to share family traits, luminous, blue-green eyes and wavy dark hair weren't bad ones. The only things he shared with his father were moodiness and a penchant for burglary. As for his mother...
Ty! Livy called. Ty, get down from there!
They had moved far enough away from the house that they were now in real chaparral desert. Kit had only been in the Santa Monica Mountains a few times on school trips. He remembered drinking in the air, the mix of salt and sagebrush, the soft, breathless heat of the desert. Hasty green lizards bloomed like sudden leaves in between the scrub cactus and disappeared just as quickly. Large rocks were tumbled everywhere, the cast-offs of some fast-moving glacier a million years ago.
I will, when I'm done with this.
Ty was busy climbing one of the largest rocks, expertly finding handholds and footholds. He hauled himself up to the top, totally unselfconscious, arms out to keep his balance. He looked as if he were getting ready to launch himself into flight, his hair blowing back like dark wings.
Is he going to be all right? Kit asked, watching him climb. He's a really good climber, said Livy. It used to freak me out when we were younger. He didn't have any kind of realistic sense of when he was in danger or wasn't. I thought he was going to fall off the rocks at Leo Carrillo and smash in his head. But Jules went with him everywhere, and Diana showed him how, and he learned.
She looked up at her brother and smiled. Ty had raised himself up on the balls of his feet and was looking down at the ocean. Kit could almost imagine him on a desolate plain somewhere, with a black cloak flapping around him like a hero in a fantasy illustration. Kit took a deep breath.
You didn't really believe what you told Diana, he said to Livy.
She whipped around to stare at him.
About not being worried about Julian and the others. Why do you think that?
Her tone was carefully neutral.
I've been watching you, he said. All of you.
I know. She looked up at him with her bright eyes, half amused. It's like you've been taking mental notes.
Habit. My dad taught me everyone in the world was divided into two categories. Those you could trick and cheat, and the ones you couldn't.
So you observe people, try to figure out what they're about, how they tick.
How do we tick?
Like a very complicated machine, said Kit.
You're all entwined. One of you moves a little, and that drives the others. And if you move the other way, that directs what they do, too. You're more connected than any family I've seen. And you can't tell me you're not worried about Julian and the others. I know you are. I know what you people think about the fair folk.
That they're evil? It's a lot more complicated than that, believe me.
Livy's blue gaze darted away toward her brother. Ty was lying down on his back on the rock now, barely visible.
So why would I lie to Diana?
Julian lies to protect all of you, said Kit. If he's not around, then you'll lie to protect the younger ones.
Nothing to worry about. Julian and Mark are off to the Unseelie Court. Hope they send a postcard. Wish we were there.
Livy seemed poised between irritation and relief, angry that Kit had guessed the truth, relieved there was someone with whom she didn't have to pretend.
Do you think I convinced Diana? She said finally.
I think you convinced her you weren't worried, said Kit.
She's still worried.
She's probably pulling whatever strings she's got to pull to figure out how to find them.
We're pretty low on strings here, you might have noticed, Livy said. As institutes go, we're a weird one.
I don't really have a lot of points of reference, but I believe you.
So you didn't actually tell me, Libby tucked a piece of hair behind her ear. Are we the kind of people you can trick and cheat, or not?
Not, said Kit.
But not because you're shadow hunters.
Because you genuinely seem to care about each other more than you care about yourselves.
Makes it hard to convince you to be selfish.
She took a few steps away, reaching out to touch a small red flower blooming on a silvery green hedge.
When she turned back to Kit, her hair was blowing around her face, and her eyes were unnaturally bright. For a moment he worried she might be about to cry or yell at him.
"Kiss me," she said.
Kit didn't know where he'd thought the conversation was going, but definitely not there. He just managed not to start coughing.
"What?
You heard me?" She moved back toward him, pacing slowly and deliberately. He tried not to stare at her legs again,
I asked you to kiss me.
Why? She was starting to smile. Behind her, Ty was still balanced on his rock, gazing out to sea.
Haven't you ever kissed anyone before? She inquired.
Yes. I'm not sure how that's relevant, though, to you wanting me to kiss you right now, right here.
Are you sure you're a Herondale? I'm pretty sure a Herondale would lunge at this kind of opportunity.
She crossed her arms over her chest.
Is there some reason you don't want to kiss me?
For one, you have a terrifying older brother, said Kit.
I do not have a terrifying older brother.
That's true, said Kit.
You have two.
Fine, Libby said, dropping her arms and turning away.
Fine, if you don't want to.
Kit caught her shoulder. It was warm under his grasp, the heat of her skin tactile through the thin material of her T-shirt.
I do, though.
To his surprise, he meant it. His world was sliding away from him. He felt as if he were falling toward something, a dark unknown, the ragged edge of unwanted choices. And here was a pretty girl offering him something to cling to, a way to forget, something to catch and hold, even if only for a moment. The pulse fluttered lightly in her neck as she half-turned her head, her hair brushing his hand.
All right, she said. But tell me one thing. Why me? Why do you want to kiss me?
I've never kissed anyone, she said in a low voice. In my whole life. I hardly ever meet anyone. It's us alone, against the whole world, and I don't mind that. I do anything for my family. But I feel like I'm missing all the chances I should have. You're my age, and you're a shadow hunter, and you don't get on my nerves. I don't have that many options.
You could kiss a Centaurian, Kit suggested.
She turned around completely at that, his hand still on her shoulder, her expression indignant.
Okay, I guess that suggestion was a little out of bounds, he admitted.
The urge to kiss her had become overwhelming, so he gave up trying not to, and curved his arm around her shoulder, pulling her closer. Her eyes widened, and then she tilted her head back, her mouth angling toward his, and their mouths slanted together surprisingly gently. It was soft and sweet and warm, and she moved into the circle made by his arm, her hands coming to rest at first hesitantly and then with greater purpose on his shoulders. She gripped tightly, pulling him in, his eyes shutting against the blue dazzle of the ocean in the distance. He forgot the ground under his feet, the world around him, everything but the sense of being comforted by someone holding him, someone caring.
Livy! Ty! Kit!
It was Diana's voice. Kit snapped out of his daze and let Livy go. She moved away from him, looking surprised, one hand rising to touch her lips.
All of you!
Diana called.
Get back here now! I need your help!
So how was it? Kit asked. Okay for your first?
Not bad, Livy lowered her hand. You really put your back into it. I didn't expect that.
Herondales don't do perfunctory kisses, said Kit. There was a brief flurry of movement, and Ty was down from the rock he'd climbed, picking his way toward them through the desert scrub. Livy gave a short, soft laugh.
I think that's the first time I've heard you call yourself a Herondale.
Ty joined them, his pale oval face unreadable. Kit couldn't tell anything from his expression, whether he'd seen Kit and Livy kiss or not, though what reason would he have to care if he had?
Looks like it's going to be clear tonight, he said. No clouds coming in.
Livy said something about better weather for following suspicious Centaurians, and she was already moving to walk next to Ty, like she always did. Kit followed after them, hands in the pockets of his jeans, though he could feel the Herondale ring, heavy, on his finger, as if he had only now remembered the weight. The lamb under the hill. The delightful plain. The place beneath the wave. The lands of the ever-young. As the hours wore on, all the names Emma had ever heard for Fairyland ran through her head. Conversation between the four of them had grown quieter and fallen eventually into an exhausted silence. Christina trudged along beside Emma, wordlessly, her pendant glimmering in the moonlight. Mark led the way, checking their path against the stars every short while. In the distance, the Thorn Mountains became clearer and closer, rising stark and unforgettable against a sky the color of blackened sapphire. The mountains weren't often visible, though. Mostly the path they followed wound through low-hanging trees that grew close together, boughs occasionally intertwining. More than once, Emma could catch a glimpse of bright eyes flashing out from between the shadows. When tree branches rustled, she would look up to catch sight of shadows moving quickly above them, laughter trailing behind them like mist. "These are the places of the wild fae," said Mark, as the road curved around a hill. "The gentry fae stay within the courts or sometimes town. They like their creature comforts." Here and there were signs of habitation, crumbled mossy bits of old stone walls, wooden fences cleverly fitted together without the use of nails. They passed through several villages in the hour before dawn. Every one of them was shuttered and dark, windows broken and empty. As they went farther into Faerie, they began to see something else, too. The first time they saw it, Emma stopped short and exclaimed. The grass they had been walking on had suddenly dissolved under her feet, puffing up white and gray like ash around her ankles. She looked around in astonishment and discovered that the others were staring, too. They had wandered into the edge of a ragged circle of diseased-looking land. It reminded Emma of photos she'd seen of crop circles. Everything within the perimeter of the circle was a dull, sickly, whitish-gray. The grass, the trees, the leaves and plants. The bones of small animals were scattered among the gray vegetation. "What is this?" Emma demanded. "Some kind of dark fairy magic?" Mark shook his head. "I have never seen any blight such as this before. I do not like it. Let us make haste away." No one argued, but as they hurried through the ghost towns and across the hills, they saw several more patches of the ugly blight. At last the sky began to turn light with dawn. All of them were nearly dropping with exhaustion as they left the road behind and found themselves in a place of trees and rolling hills. "We can rest here," said Mark. He pointed to a rise of ground opposite, whose top was hidden by a number of stone cairns. "Those will give us some shelter and some cover." Emma frowned. "I hear water," she said. "Is there a stream?"
"You know we can't drink the water here," Julian said as she picked her way downhill toward the sound of fluid bubbling over rocks and around tree roots.
"I know, but at least we can wash off in it." Her voice died.
There was a stream. Of sorts, bisecting the valley between the two low hills. But the water wasn't water. It was scarlet and thick. It moved sluggishly, slow and red and dripping between the black trunks of trees.
"All the blood that's shed on earth runs through the springs of that country," said Mark at her elbow. "You quoted that to me."
Julian moved to the edge of the blood stream and knelt down. With a quick gesture, he dipped his fingers in. It came out scarlet. "It clots," he said, frowning in mixed fascination and disgust, and wiped his hand off on the grass. "Is it really human blood?"
"That's what they say," said Mark. "Not all the rivers of Faerie are like this. But they claim that the blood of the murdered dead of the human world runs through the streams and creeks and springs here in the woods."
"Who is they?" Julian asked, standing up. "Who says that?"
"Kieran," said Mark, simply. "I know the story, too," said Christina. "There are different versions of the legends, but I have heard many, and most say that the blood is human, mundane blood."
She backed up, took a running jump, and landed on the other side of the bloody stream with some feet to spare. The rest of them followed her and trudged up the hill to a flat grassy top, which commanded a view of the surrounding countryside. Emma suspected the cairns of crumbled stones had once been a watchtower of some sort. They unrolled the blankets they had and spread out coats, huddling under them for warmth. Mark curled up and immediately fell asleep.
Christina lay down more cautiously, her body wrapped in her dark blue coat, her long hair spilling over the arm on which her head rested. Emma found a place for herself on the grass, folding her gear up to make a pillow. She had nothing to wrap herself in and shivered when her skin touched the cold ground as she reached to balance Cortana carefully on a nearby stone.
Emma. It was Julian, rolling over toward her. He'd been so still she thought he was asleep. She didn't even remember lying down close to him. In the dawn light, his eyes glowed like sea glass.
I've got a spare blanket. Take it. It was soft and gray, a thin coverlet that used to lie across the foot of his bed. Forcibly, Emma pushed away memories of waking up with it bunched around her feet, yawning and stretching in the sunlight of Julian's room.
Thanks, she whispered, sliding under the blanket. The grass was dampening with dew. Julian was still watching her, his head resting on his curved arm.
Jules, Emma whispered, if our witch light doesn't work here, and seraph blades don't work here, and runes don't work here, what does that mean?
He sounded weary.
When I looked into an inn in one of the towns we passed, I saw an angelic rune someone had scrawled on the wall. It was spattered in blood, scratched and defaced. I don't know what's happened here since the cold peace, but I know they hate us.
Do you think Christina's pendant will still work? Emma said.
I think it's just shadow hunter magic that's blocked here, Julian said.
Christina's pendant was a fairy gift. It should be all right.
Emma nodded.
Good night, Jules, she whispered. He smiled faintly.
It's morning, Emma.
She didn't say anything, only closed her eyes. But not all the way, so she could still see him. She hadn't slept near him since that terrible day Jim had told her about Parabatai and their curse. And she didn't realize how much she had missed it. She was exhausted, her tiredness seeping out of her bones and into the ground beneath her as her aching body relaxed. She had forgotten what it was like to let consciousness go slowly, as the person she trusted most in the world lay beside her. Even here in Faerie, where shadow hunters were hated, she felt safer than she had been in her own bedroom alone, because Jules was there, so close that if she'd reached out, she could have touched him. She couldn't reach out, of course. Couldn't touch him. But they were breathing close together, breathing the same breath as consciousness fragmented, as Emma let go of wakefulness and fell, the image of Julian in the dawn light following her down into dreams.
Chapter 9. These Lands. Kit soon had a new item to add to his list of things he didn't like about shadow hunters. They wake me up in the middle of the night. It was Livy who woke him up specifically, shaking him out of a dream of mantid demons. He sat up, gasping, a knife in his hand, one of the daggers he'd taken from the weapons room. It had been on his nightstand, and he had no recollection of picking it up.
Not bad, Livy said.
She was hovering over his bed, her hair tied back, her gear half invisible in the darkness.
Fast reflexes.
The knife was about an inch from her chest, but she didn't move. Kit let it clatter back to the nightstand.
You've got to be kidding me.
Get up, she said. Ty just saw Zara sneak out of the front door. We're tracking her.
You what?
Kit got yawning out of bed, only to be handed a pile of dark clothes by Livy. She raised her eyebrows at the sight of his boxers, but made no other comment.
Put your gear on, she said. We'll explain on the way.
She headed out of the room, leaving Kit to change. He had always wondered what Shadowhunter gear would feel like. The boots, pants, shirt, and jacket of sturdy dark material and heavy weapons belt looked uncomfortable, but they weren't. The gear was light and flexible on, despite being so tough that when he took the dagger from his bedside and tried to cut the arm of the jacket, the blade didn't even part the material. The boots seemed to fit immediately, like the ring, and the weapons belt sat light and snug around his hips.
"Do I look all right?" he asked, appearing in the hall.
Ty was gazing thoughtfully at his closed right hand, a rune glimmering on the back of it. Livy gave Kit a thumbs up.
You absolutely could have been rejected from the yearly Hot Shadowhunters calendar.
Rejected? Kit demanded as they started downstairs. Her eyes were dancing.
For being too young, of course.
There is no Hot Shadowhunters calendar, said Ty. Both of you be quiet. We need to get out of this house without being spotted. They crept out the back way and down the road toward the beach, careful to avoid the night patrol. Livy whispered to Kit that Ty was holding a hair clip that Zara had left on a table. It worked as a sort of homing beacon, pulling them in her direction. She seemed to have gone down to the beach and then walked along the sand. Livy pointed to her footprints, in the process of being washed away by the rising tide.
Could have been a mundane, said Kit, for argument's sake.
Following the exact path, Livy said.
Look, we're even zigging and zagging where she did.
Kit couldn't really argue. He set his mind to keeping up with Ty, who was practically flying over the dunes of sand and the boulders and uneven rocks that dotted the coastline more thickly as they moved north. He scaled an alarmingly tall wall of pitted rock and dropped down on the other side. Kit, following, almost tripped and landed face first in the sand. He managed to regain his footing and was relieved. He wasn't sure who he least wanted to look like a fool in front of, Livy or Ty. Maybe it was an equal split.
There, Ty said in a whisper, pointing to where a dark hole opened up in the rocky wall of the bluff that rose to divide the beach from the highway.
Tumbled piles of rock jutted out into the ocean, where waves broke around them, casting silvery white spray high into the air. The sand had given way to a rocky reef. They picked their way carefully across it, even Ty, who bent to examine something in a tide pool. He straightened with a smile and a starfish in his hand.
Ty, said Livy, put it back, unless you're planning on throwing it at Zara.
Waste of a perfectly good starfish, muttered Kit, and Ty laughed.
The salt air had tangled his arrow-straight black hair, and his eyes glowed like the moonlight on the water. Kit just stared, unable to think of anything else clever to say, as Ty gently placed the starfish back in its tide pool. They made it to the cave opening without any of the stops for wildlife. Livy went in first, with Ty and Kit following. Kit paused as the darkness of the cave enveloped him.
I can't see, he said, trying to fight his rising panic. He hated the pitch dark, but then who didn't?
Light burst around him like the sudden appearance of a falling star. It was witchlight. Ty was holding it.
Do you want a night vision rune? Livy asked, her hand on her steely.
Kit shook his head.
No runes, he said.
He wasn't sure why he was insisting. It wasn't as if the Urazi had heard. It just seemed like the final hurdle, the last admission that he was a shadow hunter. Not just a boy with Shadow Hunter blood who had decided to make the Institute a way station while he figured out a better plan. Whatever that plan might be. Kit tried not to brood on it as they advanced deeper into the tunnels.
Do you think this is part of the convergence? He heard Livy whisper.
Ty shook his head.
No. The bluffs of the coast are riddled with caves. Always have been. I mean, anything could be down here. Nests of demons, vampires, but I don't think this has anything to do with Malcolm, and the ley lines are nowhere near here.
I really wish you hadn't said nests of demons, said Kit. Makes them sound like spiders.
Some demons are spiders, said Ty. The biggest one ever reported was 20 feet tall and had yard-long mandibles.
Kit thought of the giant praying mantis demons that had ripped his father apart. It was hard to think of anything witty to say about a giant spider when you'd seen the white of your father's rib cage.
Shh! Livy held up her hand. I hear voices.
Kit strained his ears but heard nothing. He suspected there was another rune he was lacking, something that would give him Superman hearing. He could see lights moving up ahead, though, around the curve of the tunnel. They moved ahead, Kit staying to the rear of Ty and Livy. The tunnel opened out into a massive chamber, a room with cracked granite walls, a packed earth floor,
and a smell of mold and decay. The ceiling rose into blackness. There was a small wooden table and two chairs in the middle of the room. The only light came from rune stones placed on the table. One chair was occupied by Zara. Kit pressed himself instinctively back against the wall on the other side of the tunnel. Livy and Ty did the same. Zara was examining some papers she'd spread on the table. There was a bottle of wine and a glass at her elbow. She wasn't dressed in gear, but in a plain dark suit, her hair drawn back into an impossibly tight bun. Kit strained to see what she was studying, but he was too far away. He could read some words etched into the table, though. Fire wants to burn. He had no idea what they meant. Zara didn't seem to be doing anything interesting, either. Maybe she just came here to have privacy for her reading. Maybe she was secretly tired of Perfect Diego and was hiding. Who could blame her? Zara looked up, her eyebrows creasing. Someone was coming. Kit heard the quick tread of feet, and a tousled-haired figure in jeans appeared at the far end of the room.
"It's Manuel," Livy whispered. "Maybe they're having an affair?"
"Manu," Zara said, frowning. She didn't sound lovelorn. "You're late." "Sorry." Manuel grinned a disarming grin and grabbed for the free chair, swinging it around so he could seat himself with his arms folded over the back. "Don't be cross, Zara. I had to wait until Rayon and John fell asleep. They were in a chatty mood, and I didn't want to chance anyone seeing me leave the Institute." He indicated the papers. "What have you got there?"
"Updates from my father," Zara said. "He was disappointed about the outcome of the last council, obviously. The decision to let that half-breed Mark Blackthorne remain among decent Nephilim would offend anyone."
Manuel picked up a glass of wine. Red lights glinted in its depths.
"Still, we must look to the future," he said. "Getting rid of Mark wasn't the point of our journey here, after all. He's a minor annoyance, like his siblings."
Ty, Kit, and Livy exchanged confused looks. Livy's face was tight with anger. Ty's was expressionless, but his hands moved restlessly at his sides.
"True, the first step is the registry," Zara said. She patted the papers, making them rustle. "My father says the cohort is strong in Idris, and they believe the Los Angeles Institute is ripe for the plucking. The incident with Malcolm sowed considerable doubt in the West Coast's ability to make judgments, and the fact that the High Warlock of Los Angeles and the head of the local vampire clan both turned out to be enmeshed in dark magic..."
"That wasn't our fault," Livy whispered. "There was no way to possibly know."
Ty shushed her, but Kit had missed the last of what Zara was saying. He was only conscious of her grin like a dark red slash across her face.
"Confidence isn't very high," she finished.
"And Arthur," said Manuel, "the putative head of the place? Not that I've laid eyes on him once."
"A lunatic," said Zara. "My father told me he suspected as much. He knew him at the academy. I talked to Arthur myself. He thought I was someone named Amatus."
Kit glanced at Livy, who gave a puzzled shrug.
"It will be easy enough to put him in front of the council and prove he's a madman," said Zara. "I can't say who's been running the Institute in his stead. Diana, I imagine. But if she'd wanted the head position, she'd have taken it already."
"So your father steps in, the cohort makes sure he carries the vote, and the Institute is his," said Manuel.
"Ours," Zara corrected. "I will run the Institute by his side. He trusts me. We'll be a team."
Manuel didn't seem impressed. He'd probably heard it before.
"And then the registry."
"Absolutely. We'll be able to propose it as a law immediately, and once it passes, we can begin the identifications."
Zara's eyes glittered. "Every downworlder will wear the sign."
Kit's stomach lurched. This was close enough to mundane history to make him taste bile in the back of his throat.
"We can start at the Shadow Market," said Zara. "The creatures congregate there. If we take enough of them into custody, we should be able to seize the rest for registration soon enough."
And if they are not inclined to be registered, then they can be convinced easily enough with a little pain, said Manuel.
Zara frowned.
I think you enjoy the torture, Manu.
He leaned forward, elbows on the table, his face open and handsome and charming.
I think you do too, Zara. I've seen you admiring my work.
He flexed his fingers.
You just don't want to admit it in front of Perfect Diego.
Seriously, they call him that too? Kit muttered under his breath. Zara tossed her head, but Manuel was grinning.
You're going to have to tell him eventually about the cohort's full plans, he said. You know he won't approve. He's a downworlder lover, if there ever was one.
Zara made a disgusted noise.
Nonsense. He's nothing like that disgusting Alec Lightwood and his stupid alliance and his repulsive demon spawn boyfriend. The Blackthorns may be fairy-loving morons, but Diego's just confused.
What about Emma Carstairs?
Zara began gathering up the pages of her father's letter. She didn't look at Manuel.
What about her?
Everyone says she's the best shadow hunter since Jace Herondale, said Manuel. A title I know you've long coveted for yourself.
Vanessa Ashdown says she's a boy-crazy slut,
said Zara, and the ugly words seemed to echo off the rock walls.
Kit thought of Emma with her sword, Emma saving his life, Emma hugging Christina and looking at Julian like he hung the moon. And he wondered if he could get away with stomping on Zara's foot the next time he saw her.
And I haven't been particularly impressed by her in person. She's quite ordinary.
I'm sure she is, said Manuel, as Zara rose to her feet, papers in hand.
I still don't understand what you see in Diego.
You wouldn't. It's a family alliance.
An arranged marriage? How mundane and medieval.
Manuel grabbed for the rune stones on the table. For a moment the light in the room seemed to dance, a wild pattern of shine and shadow.
So, are we heading back? We'd better. If anyone sees us, we can say we were checking the wards.
Zara crumpled the pages of her father's letter and stuffed them into her pocket.
The council meets soon. My father will read out my letter to him there, stating Arthur Blackthorne's inability to run the institute, and then announce his own candidacy.
They won't know what hit them, said Manuel, sliding his hands into his pockets. And when it's all over, of course.
Don't worry, Zara said irritably. You'll get what you want, though it would be better if you were more committed to the cause.
She had already turned away. Kit saw Manuel's eyes glint beneath his lashes as he looked after her. There was something in his expression, an unpleasant sort of hunger, though whether it was desire for Zara or something far more arcane, Kit couldn't tell.
Oh, I'm committed, said Manuel.
I'd like to see the world burn clean of downworlders as much as you, Zara. I just don't believe in doing something for nothing. Zara glanced back over her shoulder as she moved into the corridor Manuel had used as an entrance.
It won't be nothing, Manu, she said. I can promise you that.
And they were gone, leaving Kit, Ty, and Livy to huddle together in the mouth of the tunnel, stunned into silence.
The sound that woke Christina was so faint she thought at first she might have imagined it. She lay, still tired, blinking against the foggy sunlight. She wondered how long it would be until sundown, when they could navigate by the stars again. The sound came again, a sweet, far-calling cry, and she sat up, shaking her hair. It was wet with dew. She combed her fingers through it, wishing for something to tie it back with. She hardly ever wore her hair down like this, and the weight against her neck was bothersome. She could see Julian and Emma both asleep, hunched figures on the ground. But where was Mark? His blanket was discarded, his boots lying beside it. The sight of the boots made her scramble up to her feet. They'd all been sleeping with their shoes on, just in case. Why would he take his off? She thought about waking up Emma, but likely she was being ridiculous. He'd probably just gone for a walk. She reached to pull her butterfly knife out of her weapons belt and started down the hill, moving past Jules and Emma as she did. She saw with a sort of pang in her heart that their hands between them were clasped.
Somehow they'd found their way toward each other in sleep. She wondered if she should reach down, gently separate them. But no, she couldn't do that. There was no way to gently separate Jules and Emma. The mere action of separating them at all was like an act of violence, a tear in the fabric of the world. There was still heavy mist everywhere, and the sun pierced through it dimly in several places, creating a glowing white veil she could see through only in patches.
Mark,
she called softly.
Mark, where are you?
She caught the sound she had heard before, and now it was clearer. Music. The sound of a pipe, the twang of a harp string. She strained to hear more, and then nearly screamed as something touched her shoulder. She whirled and saw Mark in front of her, holding his hands up as if to ward her off.
I didn't mean to startle you, he said.
Mark, she breathed, and then paused.
Are you, Mark? Fairies weave illusions, don't they?
He cocked his head to the side. His blonde hair fell across his forehead. She remembered when it had hit his shoulders, as if he were an illustration of a fairy prince in a book. Now it was short, soft, and curling. She had given him a modern haircut, and it seemed odd suddenly, out of place in fairy.
I cannot hear my heart or what it tells me, he said. I can only hear the wind.
It was one of the first things he had ever said to her.
It is you,
she said, exhaling with relief.
What are you doing? Why aren't you sleeping? We need to rest if we are to arrive at the Unseelie Court by moon's rise.
Can't you hear the music? He said. It was louder now, the very clear sounds of fiddles and woodwinds and the sound of dancing, too, laughter and the stamp of feet.
It's a revel.
Christina's heart skipped a beat. Fairy revels were things out of legend. The fair folk danced to enchanted music and drank enchanted wine, and sometimes they would dance for days. The food they ate made you delirious or love-struck or mad. It could pierce your dreams.
You should go back to sleep, Mark said. Revels can be dangerous. I've always wanted to see one.
A surge of rebellion went through her.
I'm going to go closer. Christina, don't.
He sounded breathless as she turned and moved down the hill toward the noise.
It's the music. It's making you want to dance.
She whirled around, a curl of black hair sticking to her damp cheek.
You brought us here,
she said, and then plunged on toward the music, and it rose up and surrounded her, and she could hear Mark swearing but following after her. She reached a field at the foot of a hill and stopped to stare. The field was full of blurred, colorful movement. All around her, the music echoed, piercingly sweet. And everywhere, of course, there were fair folk. A troop of fairies in the center of the dancers, playing their instruments, their heads thrown back, their feet stamping the ground. There were green-skinned wood fairies dancing, with gnarled hands and eyes that glowed yellow as sap. Fairies, blue and green and shimmering as water, with hair like transparent netting cascading down to their feet. Beautiful girls with flowers wound through their hair, tied around their waists and throats, whose feet were hooves. Pretty boys in ragged clothes with fever-bright eyes who held out their hands as they spun by.
Come and dance, they called. Come and dance, beautiful girl. Chica Bea, come and dance with us.
Christina began to move toward them, toward the music and the dancing. The field was still clouded with fog, carving its streaks of white across the ground and hiding the blue of the sky. The mist glowed as she moved into it, heavy with strange scents, fruit and wine and incense-like smoke. She began to dance, moving her body to the music's rhythm. Exhilaration seemed to pour into her with every breath she took in. She was suddenly no longer the girl who had let Diego Rosales fool her not once but twice, not the girl who followed rules and trusted people until they broke her trust as casually as knocking a glass off a table, no longer the girl who stood back and let her friends be wild and crazy and waited to catch them when they fell. Now she was the one falling. Hands seized her, spinning her around. Mark. His eyes were flashing.
He pulled her up close against him, his arms slipping around her, but his grip was unyielding with anger. "What are you doing, Christina?" he asked in a low voice. "You know about..."